Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to Your Book, the podcast for literary nosy parkers. I'm your book inspector, Daisy Buchanan, and the author of Insatiable, a love story for greedy girls. If you'd like a signed copy, you can order one from the Margate Bookshop. They deliver nationwide. And now, lovely listeners, I want you to have first dibs on this. My next novel, Careering, is out in March, and you can pre-order the exclusive signed edition from Waterstones.com. Signed copies are only available from Waterstones, and they do sell out. I'd hate for you to miss this one. Emma Gannon says Careering is raw, emotional, and really, really funny. Lauren Bravo says the writing is perfection, it's painfully perceptive, and will speak straight to the heart of anyone who has ever felt like their own career is playing hard to get. And I really, really want to hear what you have to say. Now, on to today's guest, Helen Oyeyemi. Helen is a multi-award-winning novelist and short story writer. New York Magazine describes her as the queen of fractured fairy tales. She writes about the lyrical, the gorgeous, the curious, and the strange. I knew I wanted to interview Helen when I read an interview where she revealed she pulled a 3-day sickie and stayed off school to read Hotel World. That's the platonic ideal of your book guest. I hope you enjoy our conversation as much as I did. So, Helen, I read an interview where you talked about discovering Hotel World by Ali Smith and that you loved it so much that you spent 3 days off school, perhaps with a cold or something, reading it. I'd love to hear about how that book found you.
I just found it in the school library. It was on the carousel. And then, as now, I don't really read the stuff written on the back of the book or like the explanation of what the book is. I just opened it, I think somewhere near the middle, and just read a couple of sentences and thought, okay, this is coming with me. And yes, from the moment that I began reading it, I just thought, okay, everything else is off the schedule. Like, I have to, like, this is my schedule until the end, which, as with most books that you really love, I never wanted to end. And also I feel like maybe it didn't end and and I'm still reading it on some level. I have those moments, I don't know if that happens to you, where I wake up and I think, has all of the stuff that happened in between adolescence and now just been a dream, and I'm going to wake up and I'll be me and me and my books, like in my teenage bedroom again. And there's something slightly nightmarish about that, but maybe also, I don't know, like there are all of those teen movies about people getting to go back to their, to go back and redo things.
I love that idea because I often think about the books I love and the characters I've loved and the life they've lived between the pages. And and something that I've loved so much about pieces is that sense of, that's the way you take a reader with you, and so much is inferred and so much knowledge is assumed, but it just feels so collaborative. And I love how much room you give a reader to have those fantasies within fantasies. And I think it's something that's what I love most about Ali Smith as well. But this idea that everyone's running around in our heads all the time.
I think that's my main thing about Ali Smith. Like, if I try and explain who and what she is as a writer, I always think of her writing as something that suggests that everything can happen. And does happen and continues to happen. And there is a just a really joyful continuity even through the dark patches. It's like there's something, there's light flowing through continually in a really consistent pattern that's also really open. Yeah, so just like open loops.
Yes, you both make me think of, you know, dark shadowy forest, but there is sunlight through the trees coming through the branches. And to write about things that are so dark and complicated and human with such a lightness and such a to find a thrill in the weird. And I suppose that kind of, you know, comes back to the, you know, myths and fairy tales, and to write about the dark, but look at what is odd and what is absurd.
I don't know, I feel like I get told a lot that I do myths and fairy tales, and I'm a little bit like, oh, I don't know about that, because I just like stories in general. Because stories themselves are weird, like especially the made up ones. I think that a story that acknowledges how made up it is and acknowledges that you are consistently making a decision. It's like what you said about collaborating with fiction, which you do have to do. You have to suspend that disbelief. You have to fill in certain blanks with your own experience or your own fancy or your own whim or your own interpretations. You have to, it's a kind of work that is also play, and you're not really sure why you're doing it or why it's essential to do it, but you know that you need to. Like there's that kind of forward drive that fiction has, and it's something that I've always, I just wonder what it is. And so I think that most of my stories about stories are trying to sort of prod and poke fiction a little bit and make it declare itself, or not necessarily explain itself, because I don't really like explaining stories, but just show a little more of its facets and why it is, and yeah, just all of the, because when you think about made up stories, they are, and their power over us actually, and our power over them, you just have a lot of questions.
I don't think I was nearly as cool or sophisticated as you, but I remember having that experience when I read, it was E. Nesbitt, and it's one of the Samoyed books. And I think Oswald, the narrator, talks about himself in the third and first person. And it's halfway through, he lets you in on the fact that he is this character he's been telling you about. And I had that moment of, you're allowed. That's so playful. That's so cool. And I didn't feel like I'd been tricked. When you're watching a magician, and I'm very easily tricked by how things are done. But again, I had that like, oh, that's permission to do something that I've not seen before.
Mm-hmm. And it's a way of seeing. It's a way of seeing a life story or any kind of story or even life itself that has been available and has been there all along, but like we just didn't consider it as as a possibility or even part of the schema. But I think that's when fiction gets most fun, when like the walls collapse and then you realize that actually maybe the walls weren't even there in the first place and everything was in fact wide open.
I think it's so interesting to consider all of this in the light of the last 18 months, which I think I felt painfully and relentlessly real. And at the same time, what you're saying about suddenly coming to and realising that everything we knew had been a dream, I think it felt like that as well. Were there any books that you found either gave you sort of comfort and space and a place to exist away from everything that was going on, or any books you turned to that helped you make sense of what was going on?
I feel like I've never been able to get away from reality or even to like, I mean, when people talk about escape, I sort of look at them wistfully, like what, how, where and how do you escape? But I do think that there was a going in during the pandemic that was kind of interesting, where it was I made some kind of decision to meet all of the fear and the worry. Like, I don't know if I would like recommend this as a way of coping with stress. It's like, let's have more stress. But for example, I reread Camus' The Plague, and like that was a super interesting book to read in terms of everything from like the very first indications that everything was going to be absolutely terrible, where you have the rats like just suddenly appearing dead on the streets, so these really fine character studies of all the different people and their ways of trying to deal with the confinement in their lives, in the way that they had been separated from people they loved or were forced to stay with people that they didn't want to be around. Like all of the scenarios in this book, which kind of has this like slightly allegorical tone to it, just suddenly became so concrete. And I remember taking like lots of furious notes, and my main note, I think, that came out was that the people who were most wrecked and destroyed in the plague were the people who were demanding that things go back to the way that they were before. Like, there was something just very relentless about Camus saying, you need to, or at least the narrator, like, not who knows what Camus was thinking, but at least the narrator of the plague saying that you need to not necessarily burn all the bridges, but not even look back or expect the past to return. Like, it's always like this forward motion that you have to make. Otherwise, and this is what happened to some of the characters, like, they stopped being allied with humanity and they became like servants of the plague, right? Like, it was all about the ways in which they were stuck in their lives that was enabling the plague to continue to spread and spread and spread. And that was kind of horrifying as well, because why wouldn't you want like all the good things that had supported and nurtured you, going back and like forward ahead of you, there's just something that's not necessarily good or pain-free, but is human. And so that was interesting reading for me, and also very like tortured involved reading. And then on the other hand, I was reading Moby Dick and just like absolutely loving it. You know, they're out at sea on like this boundless world, and
that's so weird and so spooky, because the last person we interviewed was Dave Eggers, who said, I was asking him about his pandemic reading, and he's like, wouldn't catch me reading the plague. Not really, really, no, thank you. But also, he talked a lot about Moby Dick and how he thinks, you know, for him, that is the book.
It really, that actually makes a lot of sense. I feel like Dave Eggers' writing reminds me of Melville, like the way that he gets kind of caught up in knots of life, and it's so delightfully, it's complex and chewy, and I also feel like it's writing that can tell me anything about anything. Like, I don't need to know about the specific topic. It's all about style, and I love that about Moby Dick. And I have to confess that Moby Dick is a book that I had tried to read about 5 or 6 times in my life before, and had never made it more than a third of the way through. And I guess it took a pandemic to make me finally sit down and read my music all the way through. And so for that, I am slightly grateful to Rona.
Well, I think, you know, that sounds like which I did not reread The Plague. I read a translation as a teenager, and I couldn't tell you much about it other than I think I was forced to read it. But, you know, that's moving, the sense of moving forward, that we have to sort of look for progress and look for gains. I've attempted Moby Dick and I've never finished it, but you know, you and Eggers, I'm going to do it. I'm going in.
Yay. So what were you reading during the crisis months?
Most of all, I think I always want funny books. I want, even if it's not, people aren't called, I don't want necessarily wisecracking one-liners, but I want to feel as though I'm reading about characters who will know their way around a joke, and that's what I crave.
I know what you mean. I love Woodhouse. Like, who doesn't? I feel like I haven't met anyone who says, you know what, I really don't like Woodhouse. Like, he's always gets a love from him. But actually, Woodhouse related, there's a Czech writer called Zdeněk Jirotka, who I reference. So in Pieces, there's like one of the characters gets a letter from an agency for restoring a sense of proportion in novel writing, and that's actually that's an agency that exists in Jirotka, in Jirotka's book Saturnin, which is a little bit, I think, probably inspired by Jeeves and Wooster. So you have this butler character called Saturnin, who's just like an agent of chaos. Like, he shows up promising to bring order into your life, and then everything is just tossed up in the air, and I love it so much. But one of the stories about the writing of this book, Saturnin, is that Jirotka basically wrote it, spent many hours in a bomb shelter writing it by candlelight, and none of that comes through into the book. It's like the book is this hermetically sealed space of just mischief and madcap hilarity. I wonder about the state he had to enter to write that way. And well, obviously it was just wonderfully successful, because it comes out so much in the book that it's, a time outside of time in some way. And just incredibly, like I said, incredibly funny. I have to recommend it.
I'm desperate to read it now. It sounds wonderful. And I guess that's what I was thinking, you know, this idea of escaping a book, but that you can live in while you're reading it, when that's sort of a universe that almost seems more real than our own when you're in the pages. And I think as well, what I love about P.G. Wodehouse is I think there are laws in his universe, and there's a consistency, and I don't know how it's done, where it's surprising even though you know. It's that thrill, isn't it? Sometimes that we know something's funnier the second time around because you're waiting and you know what you're waiting for, and it's delicious. And whenever I read P.G. Wodehouse, when I think about P.G. Wodehouse books, I feel hungry. You have about 8 different meals a day. I really greedily enjoy those amazing descriptions of meals and all of those rituals.
Mm-hmm. Same. Well, I feel a little bit... I read Mrs. Beaton as if it's a novel, because I think that there's a lot of a make-believe that I have to do in order to immerse myself in that world. Partly, I have to be someone who cooks in my mind, because I don't cook at all. And then I have to be, a householder, and like, and it's the Victorian times, and it's like, there are just so many different layers that you have to inhabit to even get to the food layer of Mrs. Beaton. And then once you're there, you're just like, it's a feast. So I'm just kind of reading. I don't read very many recipe books, so I'd have to say that that's the only one, just because there's so much fun. It's almost like having to put on a really elaborate costume to go somewhere in your mind. That's what it feels like.
But I love that this idea that, you know, to go to leave our lives and be a person who like uses suet and, you know, has such a straining cloths for flowers, and I don't know what Mrs. Beaton does, but
she makes it possible. I think it's something to do with the assurance with which, like, she's just like, I know that you know what these things are, and lo, you know, you are aware of these things. So there's that too, but there's also kind of an implied organization of any household. So it's kind of like, all right, you've got your cook and you've got your nursemaid and you've got like all of these this structure in place. So then you have to imagine those, and like people, you have to people your imaginary house with all of these people.
I've just reread all of the Diary of the Provincial Lady books, and
I have those on my to be read. Are they very good?
Oh, they're the most fun. And she's just gone up to wartime, and it's get really reminiscent of what has been happening here, and they're so funny and sad because the constant sort of motif in the war one is everyone is looking for war work and everyone is desperate to be useful and constantly phoning each other up and sending telegrams and saying, what can I do? just sit tight for now. There's nothing you can do. You know, wait to be called up. And she ends up volunteering in a canteen. But I love that she is constantly fretting over the management of her staff. And it's lovely because it sounds like the most unrelatable thing in the world.
Right.
She's not grand about it. And she seems to live in fear of upsetting the staff and having them leave her and not being able to find anyone new to come in. She's always saying when she goes out how nice it is to have a lovely cup of coffee because her cook can't make a cup of coffee.
But she doesn't dare say so. I think it's so interesting about domestic power dynamics as well. Like it's just not what you think it is from the outside.
I mean, I think I read a review of pieces that mentioned a sort of a Wes Anderson feeling, and that world of sort of the everything's grand and dreamy, but also that the sense of things being a little bit faded, and there's lots of sort of bustle and effort and gleam, and it's like an impressionist painting, and if you really pull in, things aren't quite working as they should be working.
Oh, I love that description of it. I think I was resisting the Wes Anderson comparisons because even though I love his films, I don't feel that Fuses came from such a visual place, because when I think of him, yes, you think very much of like the details that kind of gleam out at you. I actually went to an exhibition that he put on with his partner at this museum in Vienna. It was like being in a in a film of his, and that was wonderful. But I just, when I think of the visuals, I think that he always has them on point, whereas with pieces, yeah, there's a fadedness, there's a slight slipperiness, I like the sense that if you look again, the thing that you saw like might not actually be there, like that kind of concept, but I was thinking in a slightly filmmaker term, but actually more in terms of Rivette, this film of his that I really love, Celine and Julie Go Boating, where it's just this kind of like wild chase through a story that begins with certain motifs, like some dropped cards or a dropped scarf, and you pick those up and see where those lead. But on a train, you have this kind of trail trying to find out who people are through certain objects, certain memories that are arranged in relationship to each other.
I think that's so interesting, that the idea that, and I, you know, cannot speak for all authors or any authors really, but I know when I write fiction, I feel like what I'm describing is much more tactile than visual. I can tell a temperature in a room or the way a sofa feels against your fingertips, but I couldn't give you any kind of architectural drawing of a room that people might be in. I can, it's like, you know, with that just waking up from a dream and you can sort of almost sculpt it with your hands, but you couldn't describe it. If I can't describe it, I'm in trouble, because that's the main bit of the job.
Oh, that sounds like an interesting place, like somewhere between the interior and the exterior. So like you're just a little bit underneath the surface, but like not too deep, not too far below. Sounds like an interesting position to inhabit.
Do you give many books as gifts, or do people give you books as gifts, or do you feel as though people's reading is their business and their choice? You don't want to derail that too much.
Very much. I don't really like when people give me books or tea, because I feel like those are the things that I want to choose for myself. And also I have a long reading list, but I'm similarly reluctant to actually even give book recommendations, which is like maybe weird. So a lot of people kind of like, oh, you like books, what should I read? And I'm just like, I don't know, like, what do you like to read? Like, just find something like that. I don't know. Like, it's a very, it feels like imposing in some way. And also I'm very conscious of to be read lists, and I don't want to interrupt like the conversation between books that need to be read like close together. I don't know if that makes any sense whatsoever, but I read this book quite recently called Testimony by Charles Reznikov. It's like this almost 500 page book. It's like a very long poem, and it's about America, like about workers in America and what happens, like these disasters that happen to them. So he looked through lots of like court testimony and insurance claims, and like people just trying to get some restitution for like what had happened to them on the job. And he just like lists like all of these disasters that happened to them in blank verse. And this is early 20th century happenings. And just maybe 7 or 8 months before that, I had read Félix Fénéon's novels in 3 lines, which were just kind of very, because there wasn't very much space in his column as a journalist in this Paris newspaper in like 1906, 1907. He has to kind of boil disasters down to their essence and just like in 3 sentences, like dash them off. And just the like contrast between that expansion and like the detail of what had happened to people and why and how, and then just kind of the distillation of it. And again, the setting, different settings, America and France. I felt like those two books were in conversation with each other, and like I had to kind of like read my way outwards towards them. I think I would have been cranky if there had been some recommendation of some book that had come between them. So it was very important to like go book by book between those two.
That's really interesting. Did you consciously think of those books as sort of a pair or being somehow linked, or did this sort of find your way between them kind of organically?
I think that I had actually purchased them around the same time, but had somehow had some feeling that I had to wait. I had to choose one, read it, and then wait, because it wasn't a thematic connection per se. I think it was the way that they were both did something slightly novelistic, so like turned reality on its head in certain ways. Mm-hmm. But the source material was very much like it was the actual. And so I thought, oh, okay, this is not entirely made up, so I have to be more careful with them, with these ones, and I will take some more time with them. And then in between, I was reading all sorts of things. I read this really great novel it's a romance novel by Tessa Dare, who I think is a lot of fun, called When a Scot Ties the Knot.
That sounds super fun.
It's really cute. And it's my favourite kind of thing, where you have a lady who doesn't want to get married, makes up a suitor, and she pretends that, you know, she's passionately in love with someone, and she just like makes up a name for him, and then she sends all of these letters to some barracks that she just like makes up, and she dashes them off. And then, of course, a few years later, this person that she thought had made up shows up and is like, I got your letters and I'm ready to marry you. And she's like, this is the worst thing ever in the world. And I love it so much. It's, of course, that thing about something that you thought was not real or true, like having an actuality and a will of its own and having plans for you. And I loved it so much. And it has absolutely nothing to do with terrible things that happen to working people.
It sounds joyous. And it is so, you know, kind of meta as well, to have a character is trying to write her own story and her story turns on her.
Yeah, precisely. And it's what stories do. It's what stories do to all of us.
Exactly. And I don't know, please correct me because I might be entirely wrong, but I do think I did read you saying you had a plan for these people, and you perhaps didn't want them to be as happy in love as they were, and they kept sort of doing their own thing and going off and, you know, falling in love more to spite you.
Yeah, I had to give in to that. I mean, I was in a very bitter place where I was sort of like, okay, I'm the forever alone spinster, but I'm gonna write a train book. And or that was all I had in my mind, to write a train book. And then I had to think about whether it was going to be a destination book or like what kind of story it was going to be. And there was obviously the great temptation to write a thriller, which I think pieces slightly turned out to be. But I thought that ultimately the best type of train book to write would be one where the destination didn't matter because it was all about who you were traveling with, which would mean that it, I guess, should be a honeymoon story. And then, yes, I thought, here is my chance to take revenge on people who are in love by having this couple and having them, having terrible things happen to them. And yeah, they were just not, I think that they were either so protected by their love from me and like all of my plans, or it just is something, there's just a chaotic unfolding that's associated with love, and they're just inside their circle dealing with each other, and not really, and nothing that happens to them outside of the two of them can really be so grim or serious. And so yeah, I kind of kept trying to, I mean, you have to picture me sort of jumping around corners with terrible masks on, going, whoa, and then just going, well, I'm going to have some tea. And, you know, that's what it was like. And so then I gave in. I was just like, okay, you guys. And I think that, yeah, there's this interesting triangulation where you have to let the book be alive. So it's like between the author and the reader and, yeah, actually the characters themselves, they have to be contradictory in ways that people outside of books are as well. Otherwise there is, otherwise I think it just becomes sort of 2D. But yeah, the very unexpected elements. I mean, when I think about pieces and I think about the structure of it, I sort of knew what the story was, because there's that little first chapter, and it was kind of like, have you ever had a breakup? And then that kind of like submerges, but I knew that was what the story was about all along. And then the rest of it was just kind of letting the characters get to, I guess, the core of it in their own way and at their own pace and in their own time.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found.
LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
We'll be back with Helen soon, but now it's time for my Steal of the Week. I've chosen Nothing Good Can Come From This by Christy Coulter, a memoir written as a series of essays about love, work, sobriety and humanity. Christy's writing is ferocious, raw, tender and extremely funny. It's the story of getting sober, but tonally there is nothing sober about it. It's a challenging exploration of how to start feeling when the world would prefer you to stay numb and silent. I love this book and I return to it often. Nothing Good Can Come From This by Christy Coulter is published by Farrar, Straus and Giroux and out now. Now back to Helen.
Are there any books that you remember sort of not enjoying and you revisited and thought, oh, well, actually, that's I get it now?
I think there are, but I feel like I've also just submerged. I submerged the first reading somehow. I mean, the only one that I could think of that was significant was The Great Gatsby. But I think that that was a difference between like reading it when I was about 17 and then coming back to it like in my mid-20s and being like, this is tremendous. Like, just
what made you come back to it?
I think it's when other people just keep telling you that it's good, which is what kept happening to me. I was like, oh, is it though? And then I think actually in a slightly reverse situation, I think about The Catcher in the Rye and how I might not have loved it if it didn't hit me at the right age, because I had a similar conversation with a friend who read Catcher in the Rye for the first time in his mid-20s. He was like, this is, like, what's the big deal? And I actually think that sometimes it's just about the book hitting you at the right time in your life, like that's the case. And then there are other ones where you have different readings across the years and it just becomes deeper, more enjoyable, richer in different ways and in different directions that surprise you. I have this with Emily Dickinson. I love reading her letters. I'm starting to realize more and more how funny she is. Like, I always knew that she was she had some jokes, but it comes through more strongly the older I get with her. And I reread Little Women every year to see if it makes me cry still, and it does. I'm just like, so it just gets me in a place, that book.
That would be such a love. I might have a sort of a wintry reread of Little Women. I was thinking about the sort of this idea of the Mrs. Beaton universe and the things they do and that the feeling of that book. But I mean, I think all the time about Meg's makeover. It's the only thing that jars me in that book, the slut shaming of Meg. I think it's most unfair.
I feel like we could talk for a long time about the things that upset me about Little Women, but also the fact that you upset means that you care, which I think is very important.
When I was younger, I did not understand the Joe, Laurie, Amy triangle. And I was quite upset about Joe going off with the German doctor who seemed so...
I read the other two books afterwards just to check, because I thought, no, like, this marriage is not going to last. Like, I was just kind of like, I think that Joe and Laurie are going to get back together, and they didn't, and I didn't understand it. And that's interesting. So there's some part of me that's always dragged back to childhood by reading that and just kind of, like, having a little tantrum that things didn't work out the way that makes sense to me.
Did you read The Testaments, the Margaret Atwood book?
I didn't.
I was talking to a friend about it recently because obviously, you know, I was going to say, obviously, I love The Handmaid's Tale. Did you? Perhaps it's not obvious.
I did. I did, actually. It feels like a long time ago that I read it. And I'm almost afraid to revisit it because I'm a rereader, but, like, not always. So I don't know. But it might actually be... That might actually be a good rereading project.
I don't think I'm giving too much away to say The Testaments almost had a happy ending. And I wonder if we're at a point almost socially where you couldn't do anything else. Like, no darkness would feel greater or heavier than the one that we have. And I think it's so interesting that now there's a feeling that there's a trend for characters who are unlikable. But I don't really know, what do you think that means, like likable and unlikable?
It's a really tough one, because I think that to an extent, if a book is really doing what it needs to do, then it's kind of dissolving you into the characters anyway. So like, what are the judgments that you can make when you are the characters? Like, it's not that there should be a collapsing of identity there anyway. So a book that kind of invites you to like stand outside and say, well, I like this person or I don't like this person, is either doing satire, which is fine, I guess, but I don't know if it's really what makes me joyful about fiction. Or it's just some kind of essay, polemic type thing, which I'm not crazy about. I don't like, when I think about the books that I've strongly disliked in my lives in the story, in my lives, I guess I've betrayed my, in my many lives, like some of them reincarnations. When I think of the books that I've disliked in my life, or like the stories that I've disliked in my life, it's been the ones that have tried to like make me think a certain way, or have been so overtly didactic or fundamentally didactic. And I don't want that. And I don't want people to try and use stories like that. And so maybe the likable, unlikable falls into that, where it's kind of like, here is how you can be here is a person that people like, here is a person that should be liked, here is a person that should be disliked, and you know, that kind of tone.
When I was younger, I read Dickens that way, and I really resented him for that, and I felt, you're calling, you know, people like sort of Badness McNaughty Man. But actually, I'm really very, 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 very slowly starting to appreciate that he's sort of offering us so many philosophies to play with and borrow, and so many different ways to live, and that he calls for empathy in a way that as a grumpy teenager, you know, I didn't get.
Yeah, he definitely has a lot more nuance. And he's one of those writers that's actually fun when you don't read him as literally, and you're just kind of more, you're in a more relaxed stance with him. He's definitely, yeah, I agree. I think that as a teen I would have been like, oh, Dickens, like it's all cardboard characters. But no, they're actually flesh and blood.
I mean, you know, Dickens, Melville, Emily Dickinson, I think that someone needs to do some PR for those dead writers. And like, they're funny. I know this feels like homework and a should and a classic, but it's funny.
This is the thing. I think that we're in a strange place with branding anyway. Like, is it not even possible to kind of undo the branding of certain writers? But at least with Dickinson, because I keep up on like the kind of writing that people, the things that people write on her, I feel like there are always new takes on her, which is kind of interesting as well. Although often the takes are based on, I mean, sometimes it's just that a person is determined to find a certain thread in her work and then like pulls that out. But like, I think a lot of them are starting to acknowledge. So there's a lot of stuff about the way that she refused to finish poems, and the way that she always had like so many different variants and would never confirm the official variant, and just the ways in which she escaped the final form, like always, that I think allows a writer just to continue going and going and going through centuries.
I've been reading about Susan Sontag in the pandemic. I read the Benjamin Moser biography, but that I also just read, and it was a delightful brief afternoon, Sigrid Nunez's book about her Sempre Susan.
I just bought that.
Oh, how weird!
I think Sigrid Nunez is definitely having a moment, because so many people have also recommended What Are You Going Through? Like, but in terms, like, they've described the book so differently. So it was like three different people that described it so differently that I thought, okay, I need to have this book. But yes, Sempre Susan.
I've not read that, but I was electrified by The Friend, and I think someone else mentioned it, and it was in like not what I was expecting it to be at all. But sorry, but Sempre Susan, the vividness and the vignettes, and I think, you know, all things considered, Nunez is very generous about her, and she's trying to be accurate, but she's also capturing a woman that I believe, a woman who is always trying to define things while always resisting definition herself.
I mean, I love the essay against interpretation is kind of like, I love it so much. But yes, I think that that's I would share that view. It's kind of, there's a doubleness that must have been actually really difficult for her to negotiate.
There's a, I guess it's like a memoir or an autobiography I love, Diana Vreeland, the old editor of Vogue, and it's just called DV, I think. And it's part of a sort of group of, the only other one I can think of is a memoir written by an artist called Frances Rose, saying life, but they're both memoirs that seem, at least in part, made up. Diana Vreeland sort of writes her own myth magnificently, but also she is an old school editor in that way of sort of saying this way of doing things is absolutely right. She had the why don't you for Harper's, and why don't you wash your child's hair in champagne, and why don't you have all your luggage painted pink? I'll tell you why not, Diana Vreeland. But, you know, I think she sort of came from an enormous amount of wealth and privilege, and to some extent you could say that about Susan Sontag too. But how these women who, in the 20th century, were so confident and could contradict themselves and have that confidence in their tone.
It makes you think about what it means to be of your time, I guess, in a way. And also, maybe they were able to just sort of turn down their awareness of critique or of their audience in some way that's actually really difficult for a lot of the rest of us to access. Or maybe I think that, and this happens when I'm at a good place with writing fiction, you just are writing. It's just, you're like a verb and a noun at the same time, and you just, I don't know, just social stuff doesn't come into it in some way. And you're writing from a different place that is still you. I don't know. All of this is very nebulous, and I think is the weird thing about writing and reading that is like just indescribable.
I love the idea of being a verb and a noun at the same time.
It only happens to me when I'm writing, reading, watching a film. It's always narrative. And so I think that kind of exquisite position of authority that you're in, especially when you're writing a memoir or like something that, so you're writing about your life, which only you know, and so you get to do whatever you want, and then you can you can make up a lot of it, which is what happened. Well, then I'm thinking of memoirs that I really love Diana Athill, and I always think that it makes me wonder like how she lived, because it feels like she lived very rigorously, like as in going through every emotion like meticulously, in a way which I don't often do. Like I'm always setting feelings aside and thinking, okay, I'm gonna feel that later, and then just never getting back to the feeling. Whereas it feels like she went through everything and then wrote about it like with that similarly clear-eyed perspective. But I mean both. And then I think about Leonora Carrington's Down Below, all of these takes on a life, like whether they be like just very, very out there or like very or very concrete. There is that kind of similar acuteness that they have in common. Like it's just whatever it is very acutely that thing.
That sharpness, and I wonder how much of it is. I think a lot about the closeness of writing and reading, and how I wonder if memoirists in particular write like readers, to have that sense of editing. And it's in a way really, really generous. You know, you don't, firstly, I think no one should be obliged to tell the story of their life in any terms other than their own, you know. No, and if they want to twist the story, maybe what they invent is more real than the truth.
Exactly. So maybe there's something about the decision to even tell this that is the truthfulness and the honesty in and of itself. Like that is the offering, that it's kind of like, well, this is what happened. I'm using the language, like it might be coded in some way, but this is, I am telling you, like that kind of offering.
Diana Athill, there are many volumes of those memoirs.
And also they're just different topics. So I'm trying to think of the most recent one I read. I think it's called So Much as a Letter, but it's the most devastating one. And then she has ones that are kind of fun, like Step, where it's just like she talks about her publishing career and like just what she learned about what she learned about writers and what she learned about publishing through it. And it sort of dances a little bit. She's one of those writers that just goes into so many arenas, but like it's like somebody who has, or you see in magazines where they're like, this is the perfect day to night dress, and like you can wear this outfit everywhere. And I feel like that's what Diana Hill does, like she just is herself, but like in all of these different places and situations.
Jen is very Sontag, very Vreeland.
I have to look into this, especially the DV sounds great.
I think constantly about, I always get her mixed up with Thomas Hardy heroine, in The Europeans by Henry James. I think it is Eugenia, but it might be Eustacia. And the greatest compliment that she's ever been paid is that she's not a beauty, but she holds her head like a pretty woman. And that beauty can be mined, and you can have that power if you just sort of cosplay it. You know?
I almost feel like the power is actually in the recounting of that. Like, I feel like it dismantles the concept, because if something actually is, can it be cosplayed? Does beauty in fact exist then if it can be imitated? Like, I feel like there are a lot of questions about that, but I almost feel like all of the power has been in being able to, well, pinpoint the outlines of the story and say, okay, it's a little bit ragged around the edges here, and then start to sort of peel it back like wallpaper that needs to be changed.
And that, you know, I mean, nothing is what it seems, and there is no truth, and there are no absolutes. And what's the difference between holding yourself pretty and being pretty? And maybe there is none.
And maybe it doesn't matter. Like, also, because I feel like one of my favourite things about Jane Eyre and why I loved Jane Eyre so much is because, so she has that outburst, right? Like, even if I'm ugly, ugly people have feelings and they're important too, and like that. I was like, yes, like, finally, this is me and Jane together. Like, so what if I'm not? Like, I had, oh my gosh, so as a teenager on the bus, like, all of these stupid boys would come up to me and be like, excuse me, did you know that you're very ugly? And I would start to say, yeah, I know, thanks. Like, at a certain point, I was just kind of like, so what? Because what are you supposed to do? Like, if someone are you supposed to then just, like, go off and die? Like, so what? Like, that. And so finding that moment in Jane Eyre was invigorating. And I think that trying to make us preoccupied with whether we can be and whether we are or not beautiful is just, we have to be prepared to go to, you know, the inverse of that, and just be like, okay, what if I'm ugly? What then? Like, can I continue to live my life? Can I have feelings? Can I have love? Can I have, like, all of the stuff that beautiful women have? Yes. And so it's fine.
I think it's really interesting that that is considered to be one of the worst things you can say, right, to a woman, especially. And like, I think, you know, the word fat is so loaded, and that's what I heard a lot growing up, and it wasn't, and the word itself should be neutral, but there's so, it never, I don't think it ever will be. I think there's so much weight there, for want of a better word.
No, it's a grenade that you throw. It's kind of like they say something that's like very valid, and then you go, well, you are fat, and it's kind of like, oh, you know, the nuclear bomb has been dropped. Like, why? And why is this it's just one of those things. And then, yeah, you feel that instinct to sort of comfort Violin saying, oh, you're not fat, or you are beautiful, whatever. But it's just kind of like, what actually? So what if I am those things?
And I think, you know, back to Catcher in the Rye, maybe, to, you know, forgotten to hear that, to be liberated and to be, you know, a young woman reading those words. And it's such a call to arms. And it makes me think of, like, of Courtney Love and Kathleen Hanna and Bikini Kill and Riot Girls. And they talked about that. And again, Courtney Love, inconsistent, spent an enormous amount of time and money on arranging herself in a way that sort of fits with conventional beauty norms, but then singing there's no power like ugly.
Or even just that there's no there's no power like rejecting the current power scheme, like being told that these are the only ways in which you can succeed or have value, and just trying to come back to your own. You're kind of like, well, what do I think? What are my own fundamentals?
I don't use Facebook anymore. Other social media, sadly, I have not liberated myself from. But having those moments, think there are people who are completely consumed with what this means, but all the value that they are giving it, you know, they are giving it. It's not an objective. It's not a state. It's just, you know, there are no facts. And the power that comes from thinking, no, this is irrelevant to me and I'm not participating.
Right. I mean, what if you disconnected? It's... Then wouldn't it be less powerful? Like...
Helen, I have so many things I want to talk to you about, books and beyond books. But before we go, I should probably bring it back to books. What are you excited about reading next?
Well, now that we've talked about The Sacred Nunez, I feel like I need to push Sam Persusan further up the to-read list. What did I have next? So I finally saw that Violetta Gregg has a new book. Well, it's not so new, but this is the thing that I feel bad about, because I loved Swallowing Mercury, her short story collection, and I've seen another book of hers called Accommodations, which I'm very excited about as well.
I do not know her, but I'd love to read her. Is the new book short stories as well, or is it a novel?
I think it is. So the thing about Swallowing, like, there is something about the perspective of it, like, and its tone, which is kind of very wry, of just about everything, about growing up, about where she grew up, the times in which she grew up. Rye, but also granular. And I just loved it so much. And so I guess that Accommodations is like the grown-up Violetta. And so I'm looking forward to her takes on on the here and now.
Both really, really great names. And I love that idea. Rye and granular, that sounds like my perfect sort of book. Makes me think of Tessa Hadley, who I adore and always banging on about.
Yes, I think that we need more of all sorts of writing. But and then this is the other thing that maybe it all comes down to with all writers, that it just comes down to their individual voice, and you're just luxuriating in that, and there are as many voices as there are writers, right? And we just need more of everything.
yes, and that's the thing I think about likability and relatability, and a character can be anyone and do anything and, you know, do the best things and the worst things and have the most obscure or the most obvious sort of life. And it's the voice that propels you.
Yeah.
And I think that there's something ineffable about those things. And it's about, I think we read books because we want to spend time with people.
Yes.
And there has to be something likeable and relatable, but it doesn't have to be anything that is other than a feeling that comes from that, the voice.
It's a voice that you pay attention to it, and it somehow seems to pay attention to you simultaneously. It's really interesting.
It's perfectly put. That is gorgeous. And as much as I want this conversation to go on forever, I think that is the perfect note to end on. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, and it was a wonderful conversation.
Huge thanks to Helen. Pieces is out on the 4th of November, published by Faber and Faber, and it's beautiful. A weird, shimmering, moving love story that gave me a disturbing and joyous sense of literary déjà vu. I think you'll love it. You can follow us at YBooked on social media. Look out for book recommendations, words of wisdom from old guests, and occasional shelfies. We love it when you share the podcast with your friends, and thanks so much to everyone who has left us a 5-star review. It helps other people to discover us and new books. You can find a list of all the books mentioned by Helen at acast.com/booked, and check out her selection in our bookshop on bookshop.org. We'll be back next week. For now, I leave you with this from American Wife by former guest Curtis Sittenfeld. Being a reader was what had made me most myself. It had given me the gifts of curiosity and sympathy, an awareness of the world as an odd and vibrant contradictory place, and it had me unafraid of its oddness and vibrancy and contradictions. See you next time.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.